Good morning. This is Lance Kenmore with the Kenmore team, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's edition of the Tri-Cities Real Estate Update. We're here every Saturday morning right here on News Talk 870. As always, you can contact me, Lance Kenmore, anytime direct on my cell phone at 727-8977 or visit us on the web at kenmoreteam.com. Once again, I always like to thank John for hosting and everybody here at the station for working to make this happen. John, how's everything going?
Well, Mother Nature can't make up her mind.
No, but that is okay, McKay. And let me tell you why. So last week I went with my son. He had a tournament in Detroit. So we just last couple of days. So we were out in Detroit, and I got caught up in that Midwest Eastern snowstorm, and so we had the 5-6 inches one night when we were back there, along with -4 degrees. And I got home earlier this week, and it was 38 degrees, and there was no snow, and it was beautiful, McKay. So I will tell you, I got my fill, and we don't need it. We don't need to see it here at all. And we're having just a blockbuster January start to the year. So it cannot make up its mind. A little flurry here and there was just fine, but I'm liking what we have, McKay.
Well, Mother Nature let me down, so just bring on spring. We didn't get our snow.
Nope, absolutely. We're not out of the clear yet, though. We got to remember, it's still January.
Yeah.
We've got here with us in studio, back with us, Mr. Mike Denslow, our in-house lending specialist from Home Street. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Yeah, I'm with you, Lance. You know, temperature in the upper 30s, low to mid 40s. People are just keep coming in to get pre-approved for loans, and we've talked about it before. If they don't have ice and snow slowing them down, they're going to go look.
Yeah, they are. They are absolutely going to go look. And I got to tell you, coming back to the Tri-Cities, I mean, I don't have anything against Detroit. Don't get me wrong. I saw some cool car, you know, museums back there, and the whole Henry Ford influence and GM's headquarters, but it is nice to come home to Tri-Cities.
Yes.
You know, lots of not as much traffic. The streets are clean. There's not a bunch of abandoned houses everywhere.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. I'm always thankful of where we live.
Yeah.
Well, before we jump into today's topic, we always like to start off with our crazy celebrity real estate topic. And sometimes it's interesting to buy a house that is specifically done from an expert. And so on the market is HGTV's kind of renowned landscape designer. There's a show called The Outdoor Room with Jamie Dury. And he designs amazing backyards and landscapes. Well, he's put his personal home on the market. And so, mind you, this is in LA's Laurel Canyon. So it was a mid-century modern, and totally went through and renovated. So instead of paying him to come design your backyard, you could just buy his backyard.
Well, we know with landscaping and pools and all that kind of thing, it's never dollar for dollar. So I hope he's not asking too much, Lance.
Well, Mike, there's a lot to be said for that. He might be. He bought it in 2009 for $950,000. It doesn't say exactly how much he put into it, but it did go over some of the amenities. And he went crazy in the backyard. He did the fire pit. He did the pool. He did the outdoor kitchen with the built-in cabana. And then just because, you know, he is a landscape designer, he did the separate design studio that is off by itself, almost like a casita type. And so, yeah, you know, for a cool, mind you, $2,950,000 listed now for $2.9 million.
Oh,
so I know there's been some appreciation there. That's not my market, so I don't know exactly, but yes, definitely asking for a little bit of increase. So we will see if that is reported later in a sale.
You know, the best part about taking a walk through a house like that as a prospective buyer. He's from an HGTV lawn landscape. Walk up and go, ha, you missed a spot.
Absolutely. From the pictures I saw, I don't know how many he missed, though. It is pretty stunning.
Probably not.
But there's probably a weed or two poking through there occasionally. We always like to temper that with kind of our local story. So it was great. Last week, we talked a lot about predictions. We went through the predictions I got wrong, the ones I got right. And it really was kind of an overview of the market. At the same time, many people might have seen Tri-City Journal of Business released in their January release that the right on the front page, hot Tri-City housing market showing signs of slowing down. We talked about in the predictions last week that, yeah, we've had multiple years of, you know, 10% price appreciation. We were predicting that to slow down a little bit. A lot of quotes in there from one of our friends of the Tri-City Real Estate Update, Jeff Losey, talking about building permits. And they still saw, you know, as they finished out 2018 and they compiled their numbers, the article reported that in 2018, Benton and Franklin counties, the number of single-family home permits that were issued increased just under 2%, so 1.7%. We talked about how the total number of sales just were right around 4,400. That was supported in this article, almost exactly what we reported on the show last week. So,
and how did that compare with the year before?
It was almost house for house. It was 27 or 23 more. It was less than one half of 1%. So it was really, really close. And
that doesn't sound like slowing down to me.
It is more of a leveling. Yes. Maybe the amount of growth is slowing, the percentage of growth, but right. The actual gross numbers, it's still projected to be another in, you know, I define this, it's not a new normal, but it's a barn burner. I mean, that's a lot of sales for our market. And so hopefully, though, that we continue to see, you know, what I don't like to see is I've been hoping that we get back to 1,000 homes on the market. And I don't like to see the number of permits decreasing because I'm still looking for that balance to the supply of homes. And so I hope they don't decrease sharply to where we continue to have inventory in the 600s when we're really wanting that 1,000 number for me personally. But maybe, Mike, it shouldn't just all be all about me personally.
Maybe it should be on the show, though.
I think that's good for buyers and sellers, though, when we get to that balanced market. Especially buyers. And so we've done a couple shows about selling and prepping your home. So that takes us right into the topic that I was going to talk about. And this week, earlier in the week, my team and I were going over some strategies and talking about contracts. And one of the things that came up was earnest money and how a lot of people don't necessarily understand what earnest money does and then how it works as a vehicle, what part of the sale where it comes into play. So I jotted down some notes and we talked about it. We had watched a video that the Washington Association of Realtors puts out and their legal team talks about some of the issues that come up with it. But basically what in contracts, what earnest money is generally considered, if you go all the way back to like contract 101, is there needs to be some consideration to make a contract binding. And so earnest money is one way how we've done that. So
mostly consideration to the seller.
Exactly. So what are you offering other than your promise, you know, to purchase? But that's earnest money is like a deposit. And so a lot of people, their first question to me always is, well, how much earnest money should I put down? And they think there's a rule, but there is not a rule. So sometimes, like any business, there can be unwritten rules and people might hear what is standard. Well, that standard isn't defined anywhere. There might be what we see happen a lot in the industry, an average amount. And so generally, if someone's looking, say, at a $200,000 house, the question that we always go back to the buyer with is, what amount is, number one, do you have available today? Because once we come to mutual acceptance of this contract, we're generally going to deposit that earnest money with the escrow company to hold until closing. And so then a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, well, what happens with it at closing? That's always our follow-up question. And so we'll get into that in a minute. But back to that question is, what do you think is going to make the seller feel comfortable with accepting your contract, that you have some skin in the game, that you are financially able to purchase? And so subconsciously, the amount of earnest money that you put down is also in negotiations sending a message to the seller. And so you'll hear a lot of people in the industry will say, well, gosh, a lot of times I see 1%. So you're buying a $200,000 house. We get a lot of contracts that come to us. $200,000 house, $2,000 earnest money. We also get a lot of contracts that come to us. Maybe they're using a 00 VA loan. And so they're asking the seller to pay some of the closing costs. And that buyer is expecting to not have to come up with any cash out of pocket. So they might, if they were using a VA loan, they might put down $500 because it's that likely could be, in different scenarios, refunded back to them at closing. And they don't want to be out that cash for the next 45 days. And then on the flip side of things, we've seen people that are saying, well, even though I am doing a VA loan or doing that, I really want to tell this seller I'm serious. So if you if instead of just 1%, I'm going to put down 2 or 3%. I'm going to do $6,000 in earnest money because I want to show them that I am financially capable and I mean business.
And then I'm waiting for the other side. Okay, so now that happened.
Absolutely.
And so, what does that mean?
So now that happens, and the next question is always, what does that mean? And so a lot of times people be like, well, gosh, am I going to get that money back, or how's that going to happen? Well, in the context of that deal, you're putting that earnest money down. Say we're buying that $200,000 house and you're putting 10% down at closing and getting a 90% loan. So you put down your $5,000 earnest money, we'll say, and you move forward and you start with your inspections and stuff and you're moving towards closing. Let's say you get through everything and you get down to closing. $200,000 house, you're bringing $20,000 in as your 10% down. Well, that earnest money that you've already deposited, that $5,000, counts towards the purchase
Let the lending guy jump in here. If we can verify where the money came from.
Yes, absolutely.
So if that check was you took cash in and they gave you a cashier's check and you did it, obviously we can't use that. If we need to have verifiable funds, and as long as we can verify where that came from, then we can use that money.
Yes, absolutely. So if you can show where that money came from and that it came from your finances,
then we can back it out of your down payment and it will count towards the down payment as a deposit.
Absolutely. So whether that's towards the closing costs that you pay, so basically if it's cash to close, you need to bring in $25,000, but you have a $5,000 earnest money deposit, then you're only going to have to bring in $20,000 at closing. The next question that comes up a lot, and one of the things I was going to talk about today, is people say, but gosh, Lance, I want to make sure that the house is sound. No matter what, I've always heard, I've listened to your radio show, we're going to get an inspection. So what's going to happen to my $5,000 if we do the inspection and there's termites and the house is falling down and there's plumbing problems? I don't want to buy it. So one of the things that we do is then we have paperwork, we have addendums, and we have what we call contingencies that protect that earnest money for the buyer. So for instance, the language that comes right out of our statewide forms in the inspection addendum says that this inspection contingency shall conclusively be deemed waived unless within 10 days after mutual acceptance of this inspection, buyer gives notice disapproving the inspection and terminates the agreement, the earnest money shall be refunded to buyer. So the buyer is protected within that first 10 days. If they have that home inspection, they find items in there that they do not approve. There is language built into that that says they can disapprove the inspection, and then they will get that $5,000 deposit back.
Assuming they're working with a good agent who knows the contracts and addendums inside and out.
Absolutely. And you have to follow those guidelines. There's negotiated days in there for those responses and for those deadlines. And what happens a lot of time is we get into situations too. There's built-in clauses in that inspection addendum that says if inspector one finds issues that are outside of his scope, then you can have so many extra days to do additional inspections. Now, that's also a negotiated item. So if in the walkthrough you say, gosh, there's something that just doesn't look right about this roof or maybe the septic system, you know, we might need additional inspections. You can pre-negotiate the number of days for additional inspections. So say the general inspector just says, gosh, everything looks good, but I think I see some... The way they did the roof and the flashing on those corners, just it doesn't make sense to me. You need an actual certified just roof inspector to come out. Mm-hmm. There's a clause in the inspection addendum that keeps your earnest money protected, allows you additional days to get those additional inspections, and then you can come in, get that checked out. Because once you then waive that inspection or move outside of that period of inspection, then that contingency is satisfied or waived. If you find or discover something afterwards that you're not happy with, then it's going to be much harder to recover your earnest money if you cancel the transaction.
And it just makes me think of the people that say, oh, do I need my own real estate agent?
Yeah, we've had some sad calls like that where people call me afterwards and say, gosh, you know, I just... We had something written in the contract that said I could have an inspection. I thought that meant I was covered for my earnest money. I did have the inspection. I found things, but now the seller is saying that he's keeping my earnest money. He said he allowed me to have an inspection, but he didn't agree to fix anything or that he would give me my earnest money back. And if, you know, when someone writes their own contract and it's just one line, you know, we can't help them with that. We have to then refer them to an attorney. It gets really complicated and expensive really quick. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. That is our big thing with earnest money, is how do you get it back? What's the process for that? And what type of contingencies protect you in those situations? When we come back from the break, we're going to talk to Mike Denslow at Home Street about what's going on in the lending world, and then talk about identifying your potential buyer when you get ready to sell.
Right here on News Talk 870.
Welcome back to the Tri-Cities Real Estate Update. We've been talking today about contingencies and earnest money, when that gets credited to buyers. Also, how to protect yourself during the initial stages of a contract. On the flip side, when we're working with sellers about getting through those contingencies, you know, you really have a little internal battle there when, as a seller, you're wanting those contingencies to get cleared. You're wanting to get through the inspection. You're wanting to make sure their financing is in place. They've applied for their loan and they're moving forward, because that's a big contingency also. So as a seller, you're wanting to clear those contingencies and make sure that the deposit they put down, that there's also a continued good faith. As a buyer, you're wanting to protect that deposit as long as you possibly can, and also make sure you're making steps to get that transaction finished. One of the biggest parts about that is that financing contingency and the requirements that it has. And that's why we're always so adamant on the show talking about getting people over to Mike at Home Street, getting him started on that application quickly, because Mike, we're usually not joking around, but generally once they get that contract ratified, they have 5 days to really complete, in general, depending upon what you've negotiated, but generally they really have 5 days by default in most contracts where they have to get to you and get that application cooking.
Yeah, I'm happy to say that recently I've had more buyers coming and saying, well, my agent said I needed to do this first.
Yes, I love it. Where the radio show's helping finally.
Yeah. And so that's great, because, yeah, you don't want to find a house and then figure out the financing later, because earnest money's at risk and everything else is at risk, and it's just could be a big waste of time to find out that, oh, well, I can't buy because I just had somebody in my office that came in and sat down and graduated college and started her own business, and it's going really, really well, and she's been doing it for 6 months and she wants to buy a house. Oh,
that's going to be a problem to document the history there.
Exactly.
But they don't know that. They've never done this before. They just graduated.
Exactly. So she came in. Luckily, she came in at the recommendation of her agent and came in. We sat down and we talked about it. And so now we're looking at, you know, a co-signer with mom or a sister or someone else. Another thing I wanted to bring up is a week ago, I had an agent get a hold of me. Hey, can you get this gal pre-approved right now? There's a multiple offer situation. 11 offers.
Wow.
And in the low 200 price range.
Yep.
And they accepted our offer because of their comfort level with Home Street Bank and our pre-approval letter. So
that's huge. And I mean, that's funny, because it's not funny, but I'm sure there's some people that listen to the show and we talk through these scenarios. And I know you and I, we really just, I mean, every week we just sit down for the show and we bring, you know, real scenarios to the show. And so crazy. But yeah, and that price range in January, still looking at properties that have 11 offers on them.
Yep. And yeah. So that one worked out really well. Then, you know, people ask, where are all these people coming from? They still ask for that. And California, Switzerland relocation.
Wow.
For employment. Just all the time, different parts of the country, different parts of the world are still moving here. Tri-Cities has got good jobs, good economy. And but when I was thinking about the show, I was thinking about the different types of buyers that we represent and then how that related. So I know the majority of the show typically is around listings, but I was wanted to talk about buyers. And I really saw, you know, I really see four different types of buyers. I see the first-time home buyers.
Yep.
And then I see the move-up buyer, meaning they've lived in a house for 3 to 7 to 10 years, and now they're ready to buy their house where they're really going to lay down roots and they're going to start a family, and that's going to be their family home for a while. And then I see the downsizers that, oh, you know, we're later in life, and now we're living in this 3,000-square-foot house. We don't want to clean it, and so we want to move down to something. And then relocation. You know, yep. I'm moving in here for my job. And those four pretty much cover most. And I was thinking, well, how does that relate to your side and the listings and people are selling their homes? You know, why should they know what type of person would be expected? Not that it's going to be 10 out of 10, but maybe 7 out of 10 are going to be this type of buyer.
Yeah, Mike, and that's a great question. And one of the things that it is constantly changing, but one of the things in the last year that has really helped us is that we are sometimes able to break down those demographics and then do some targeted advertising. So if you think a house, for instance, is in a great position for a first-time home buyers in a price point, let's say it is in that 200. You mentioned that bracket. Let's say a house is from 200 to 250. Well, you might say, gosh, you know what? This is perfect for a first-time home buyer. One of the things we can do now is drill down our categories when we're advertising on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. And one of the things that we can do is we can say, hey, we want to show this house when somebody types in the words first time home buyer, or they're talking about it in their conversation on Facebook. So one of the things they have changed is Facebook did get into some trouble a couple months ago last year because there was a fair housing violation where these ads were being able to target people by familial status or age, which violates the Fair Housing Act. But first-time home buyers are not a protected class yet. McKay, that's a joke.
As long as you don't, as long as you don't,
yes,
the, you know, first-time home buyer, it doesn't meet any of
does
the other criteria.
Does not mean an age
like,
that does
like
not,
single.
A first-time home buyer, could be somebody in their 50s. It could be, you know, it could be somebody in their 20s. So not talking in those protected classes, but you could say, gosh, okay, let's get this out there. So now you're targeting your ads. You're able to target your ads. And then you're also able to make the house appealing for those demographics. So there's something you could maybe you could talk to and you consider, hey, if somebody's a first-time home buyer, they might not have the cash available. Maybe we're willing to cover some closing costs, or maybe we're going to need to cover some closing costs because of the price point that we're in. So as a seller, you can be prepared to negotiate based upon kind of your ideal buyer that's coming in. Also, you can also do some things where Mike talked about. A lot of times we end up with a house that is might be great for a first-time home buyer, but also might be perfect for somebody downsizing. So we'll look at that category, and maybe we have a great family that has raised their kids, and they have painted pink walls and neon green walls. And so this is going to go to staging, but I want to think about it. A lot of times it's not staging. It's exactly what Mike's talking about, and that's the buyer that you want. And so you talk to that family and say, hey, I know this was a family house for you, but the buyer, it very well could be another family with kids, maybe. But it also, your house is the perfect size. It's a Rambler, smaller square footage. Your house might be perfect for a buyer that's downsizing. They're going to be put off by the children's toy room and the different colors on the walls. So let's do some staging and some painting and now have this appeal to not only the first-time home buyers, but let's now have this a look that appeals to somebody that's potentially downsizing. And so you might make some changes in the house that broadens the number of people that are willing to look at it. And I always say, if we can increase the audience, increase the target number of buyers, we're going to have a much better chance of selling. So Mike, that is just a great topic. And I mean, it's a lot of times people get caught up in just their situation and never thought that this would be a great house for somebody that's downsizing.
Yeah, I think all those points are right on the head, Lance.
The other thing that we run into a lot of times too is the move-up buyer. Mike mentioned it, and that's when sometimes it's even more important for someone to get together and talk to Mike. A lot of times you've lived in a house for 10 years. You've made all your mortgage payments. You get, I don't know the right exact word, but you get comfortable with your situation and think that buying your next house is no big deal. Because you've just been rolling along and now you make more money than you did 10 years ago and you've gotten a promotion. But there's a lot of things that I think Mike is going to point out that will help.
Well, yeah. And some of that is, oh, well, I'm working and my wife hasn't been working because we just had 3 kids, but she just went back to work for 2 months and is making great money, and now we want to use her income as well. Stuff like that
that you don't think about. So even if you're a move-up buyer who has great credit and has been making all your payments for 10 years, we still suggest give Mike a call at Home Street. Mike, based upon that, what is the best way, website or phone, for people to get a hold of you?
You know, I see a lot of people just promoting websites and that, but I like the personal touch. I want people to call. I want to be able to interview them to talk through things, because if you're filling out a form online, you're going to miss, you're not going to say something, and you can't ask you know, organic questions. And so 572-3651 is my direct line.
Absolutely. And for people that are driving or miss that, you can always go to kenmoreteam.com, shoot us a message, and we'll get you right over there to Mike's team. And we will be right back next week talking about more real estate.
Right here on News Talk 870.